Welcome to the Changemakers Podcast, produced by City Current and brought to you by Lipscomb and Pitts Insurance. This show shares personal stories and insight from those who are giving back and making a difference so we can learn and do the same. We cover life lessons, business advice, passion, and purpose. Now here's our host, the CEO of City Current, Jeremy Park.
Welcome to the Changemakers Podcast, produced by City Current, powered by Lipscomb and Pitts Insurance and Higginbotham. I'm your host, Jeremy Park. On this episode, we're talking about philanthropy, disruption, innovation, how the landscape is changing when it comes to giving focused on impact. We are joined by Jared Barnett. He's the CEO of Slingshot Memphis. How are you doing, Jared?
I'm doing great, Jeremy. Thank you.
So let's dive in, because the fun of this is we will talk a lot about Slingshot Memphis and how everything is shifting toward impact and partnerships, working alongside nonprofits and corporations and foundations. We'll talk all about that. But the fun is we get to know you. And so give us a little bit of just your childhood, where you grew up. Let's start there.
Yeah, sounds great. So I grew up on the West Coast. So born in California, but raised up in Oregon. Spent all of basically my primary and secondary school up just kind of in the suburbs west of Portland, Oregon. Loved playing sports growing up. So that was a big thing for me. Football, basketball, baseball, track. Just love being outside, love, you know, competing and having fun there. Also developed a lot of fun for the outdoors. So I think, you know, that's something that's carried with me from Oregon. I haven't lived in Oregon since high school, but I've taken my love for the outdoors with me. And so, you know, old support kids. So I got, you know, the big brother syndrome, and love kind of taking care of my siblings, although they're all doing great right now. And, you know, parents are still back up there. And so we get to go back and see them every now and then.
Where did your desire to make a difference come from? Was that something from your parents? Was that something through, you know, growing up in different organizations? Where did that come from?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I don't know if I know the answer, but I think for me, you know, my faith definitely had an influence on how I wanted to spend my time and how I wanted to try and help and contribute towards others. And then I think I just have this innate desire to do something more, you know? And so it's always been important to me to think about other people, how they're experienced, you know, how they're experiencing things. You know, I had lots of opportunities, you know, through my childhood, through sports and academics. And so it was always important for me when I was, you know, a captain of a sports team or something of that nature, that we had a cohesive group and that people didn't feel left out. You know, if we're going out to eat as a team, that other people could make it, even if they, you know, didn't have the resources normally to do that and things. And just that was just kind of wired in me. You know, I didn't necessarily know how to always use it, but it was just there. It's probably the best way I describe it.
What's a tradition or something that you look fondly on from your childhood with your family?
Yeah. So I think one thing that was always fun for me is that, you know, twice a year, my church would do a kind of a big conference, and my dad would always take me. And then when my little brother got old enough, we'd go to the men's session of that conference together. And then we'd always go out and get ice cream afterwards. And so I don't always remember what we talked about on those conferences, although they were informative. But I remember the ice cream we got afterwards. It started with Baskin Robbins. So I'm dating myself back, you know, here a while, but we did, you know, the Baskin Robbins for a while, and that evolved as other options came available. But that's something that just, you know, even, I mean, that started when I was probably 8 or 9 years old and went all the way through high school. And then my younger brother, who's a couple years younger than me, joined when he, you know, was old enough. And that was just a fun memory for my dad and I and the boys in the family to get some time together.
So you went to BYU. Talk about going to college and starting to kind of go in the business and strategy and operations. Talk about kind of that shift on your end, the corporate shift.
Yeah. So, you know, I went to college thinking I'd be an engineer. I took one engineering class and decided I did not want to be an engineer. and I actually think what was really formative is I left college for 2 years and went and did mission service for my church full time. And during that time, I was in New England and I met Clayton Christensen, who is professor at Harvard Business School, was a member of my faith. And so we had the opportunity to interact through a few things. And I didn't know who he was at the time. I wasn't even thinking of that stuff. But as I got to know him and hear his discussions we had together, it kind of helped me think, like, I like what he's doing. I like what he's talking about. And when I came back and re-enrolled in college, I started to say, well, what else do I want to do? What would I find interesting? And business kind of came on the radar. And I learned pretty quickly that consulting was interesting to me. And you know, the idea to solve challenging problems, work on things that mattered, that's where this impact concept really started for me, was around my consulting career and the impact that we were trying to have as consultants. But in undergrad, I figured that out really quickly. And I joined a consulting club. At the time, I was the third member, active member of that club, where BYU was not a hub of consultants for when I started. That's changed in an exciting way since then. But yeah, so that's kind of where I did. And then in school, you know, Brigham Young University has a really strong accounting program. And so that's probably the most respected program they have. So I said, well, hey, let's go for that. I'll get the best education possible, and then I'll figure out what to do with it. And I realized pretty quickly I didn't want to be a CPA. You know, nothing against CPAs. That's just not where my personality aligned. And so I was kind of this black sheep in the accounting program, because at least 90% of my colleagues went to Big Four accounting firms. And here I am trying, you know, talking about organizations like McKinsey and Bain and BCG and other consulting firms. It's kind of just this, what's this weird guy talking about? So I've kind of embraced being a little bit different and kind of doing my own thing. And it was through that experience. And really, I had some really powerful mentors who were, you know, graduates who had, you know, gone to school at BYU and gone off into the consulting world. And they were really the biggest influence on me and helping me find the right path, you know, after undergraduate. And so really grateful for others, you know, contributing to me. And I think a lot of that has created this pay it forward mindset, right? Of like, you know, other people who had no need to do anything for me, but still made the time to help me out in a way that, you know, my family didn't have experience what it was like in the consulting world. I didn't have, you know, others I could, you know, a network of people I could rely on. It was just these people who were alumni from my school who went out of their way to kind of coach me up and help me figure out, you know, all the things I didn't know I didn't know.
Yeah, absolutely. Talk about getting your MBA and then really also too transitioning to leaving the States and going overseas and serving in other countries.
Yeah. So, you know, I moved to Dallas right after undergrad and was lucky enough to work with McKinsey & Company right away. Spent 2 years in the U.S. doing consulting, loved it, had a great time. But again, this thing inside me, I was never really satisfied by being so far from the impact that we were having, right? And we did great things, but when you work with Fortune 500 companies, the end consumer who benefits or the end person who sees the value is so far removed from, you know, the corporate office or even the factory floor, which I spent a lot of time in operations. And so the idea was, as a third year business analyst at McKinsey, you had a chance to kind of pursue something that was more of an interest to you. And so I said, well, hey, like, let's go abroad. Let's go do something different. Let's go see what, you know, what kind of impact you can have in a developing economy. And so I was lucky enough to have the opportunity to go to the Johannesburg office. And I got to spend about 3 to 4 months in East Africa. I spent a couple of weeks up in Lagos, Nigeria, and then spent the rest of the time kind of in the mining community there in South Africa. And just it loved it. It was a great experience, really kind of stretched my horizons a bit. And I got so excited. I said, well, hey, let's leave consulting and go do something more. And so my original thought was to go and start a business in Africa and say, hey, you know, there's a lot of gaps in these economies that I feel like I could, you know, fill. And so I had a very good Ghanaian friend who I'd happened to become good friends with in college and undergrad. And so we came up with this crazy idea of, you know, as the American, I should go to Ghana and start this business. And as the Ghanaian, he should stay in the U.S. and, you know, kind of help fund it. And so we tried this out, got there, realized really quickly that, you know, after I'd moved my family, my wife and two kids to Ghana, that like some of our assumptions weren't as accurate as we thought. Inherently, I was always going to be charged a different price because of how I looked versus what he would have been charged. You know, that's when you work in a barter economy, a lot of times you prices adjust very quickly. And so I ended up joining a financial advisory firm there. And got to do kind of traditional M&A work in Africa, as well as this company had purchased a few businesses. They were trying to become a private equity firm. And so they had made some ad hoc acquisitions. And so, you know, on my, you know, one day job, I ran a manufacturing company. And my other day job, I got to, you know, be the vice president for these different deals. And so just a great experience. For me, I think the most valuable part of that was stretching my perspective and my paradigm of the world. Right. So the first 6 months I was in Ghana were probably some of the most challenging times of my life. And it's not because I was doing something wrong or people were doing anything wrong, but it was just adjusting to what things were like there. It was, you know, I feel like when you go to a new country, there's the honeymoon that you have, right? Everything's cool. Any inconvenience isn't a big deal. Or when you go to visit a place, you don't get there long enough or deep enough to kind of see some of the challenges. But after we kind of blew through that in month 3 to 6, it was like, wow, this is hard. Like, I don't understand this. Why does someone do this to me? Why did this happen? And it was through that time of kind of after 6 months there where I'm living it, seeing it, you know, immersed in it, that a lot of these things that looked really stupid and illogical up front, where you're like, why would anybody ever do that? You start to understand why. And so for me, that's been a really powerful framing for the rest of my life to realize that just because something doesn't make sense to me means that it's wrong. And just because something doesn't make sense to me means that, you know, it doesn't make sense to them. And so it's been a powerful experience for me, painful, because it really was a stretch, but really powerful to kind of help me understand. And I think the experience I had, particularly working in the factory where I manage over 200 people, most of them without college educations, many of them without, you know, even high school educations, it gave me a perspective around poverty in a very different environment and helped me realize how people make trade-offs and how people think about things and how they're still very logical, but they're working with a different set of factors and a different set of challenges than I was used to based on how I was raised and the, you know, the things that I was able to be blessed with and my upbringing. And so that was transformative for me, put very simply. And business school had always been kind of a goal of mine. That's kind of something that my father always regretted not having a chance to go get his master's. And so I wanted to do that. And so I got the opportunity to do that, was lucky enough to get into a school like University of Chicago. And so got to go there, had my two kids who I had taken with me through Africa. And then we had our third while we were in business school. And that was just great, like a chance to learn. And I think originally I thought of my career, I wanted to be a Fortune 500 CEO. Then I realized I don't want to deal with big like that. I want more nimbleness and flexibility. So when I was in business school, I was much more like, I want to be an entrepreneur and kind of chase something and build something. And I kind of learned pretty quickly that to be a good entrepreneur, you need to know a lot about something. And I knew a lot about, or a little bit about a lot of things, but I didn't know a great depth just because of the career path I had taken to that point. And so rather than trying to go and be an entrepreneur right away, I said, let's go back, you know, to something I know, something where I know I can control what I get to learn. And so I went back into consulting afterwards, expressly with the idea of getting smart on things that I was passionate about, with the aspiration of trying to do something disruptive and something more entrepreneurial at some point.
There's a lot of great advice that people can unpack just within that journey there. You talk about how it reframed your perspective, the empathy, kind of putting yourself in someone else's shoes, especially on the business lens. For you on the marriage side, the family side with the kids, how was that, you know, the experience in Africa? How did that play out in terms of you becoming stronger as a family unit?
Yeah. So it forced us to really work some of that out together, right? So South Africa was much more challenging for my wife than it was for me. I got to transition very quickly into a business environment that was not dramatically different than what I had experienced in the US and felt very comfortable. My wife had to transition into, you know, post-apartheid South Africa that was only 20 years removed from, you know, a very structural racism, right, that was in place. And so there was a lot of things that she had to deal with and see that were not comfortable for her that made her feel just not happy, right? It wasn't something that she enjoyed. And then in Ghana, it was very different, where much less, you know, kind of policies and government regulations and things of that nature from a business side. So I had to deal with a lot more ambiguity and a lot more, I came in across a lot more things that I was uncomfortable with from a values perspective, where my wife was able to just embrace a group of people that is incredibly loving and cheerful and kind. And it was very different. And so we helped each other through these differences that we had and really, I think, created it for us and for her and I, a different way of connecting as we worked through the various challenges that we faced. For my kids, I think it was fantastic because we put them in kind of preschool like type things. And in almost every case, they were the only American there. And in often cases, they were the only white student there in those schools. And so very different experience for them to, you know, kind of understand what it's like to be a minority. You know, my son used to hate walking home from school because there was several schools that get out at the same time. And he was this little pale skinned, blonde haired kid. And it was just something that many of these youth there had never seen before. And so they would want to come up and touch his hair and, you know, kind of do this. And it traumatized him in a way, because he's just like, you know, yes, I'm different, but I don't want you just like treating me like an object, right? Or this thing, I want you to talk. And so we had to learn about these things in a way that, you know, had we not been there, had we stayed in kind of what we were comfortable with here in the US, we just never would have experienced that. And so it's given my wife and I a lot more, I like the word empathy that you use, just we can understand things in a way we never could before. And that doesn't mean we can perfectly relate with everybody, but we get there's a lot that we don't know. And we're very comfortable knowing that just because we don't understand it doesn't mean that we can't relate to challenges that are there, that we can't, you know, we understand that there's a very logical process that people go through to make the decisions they do in ways that we couldn't have comprehended without that experience.
Yeah. So let's get to Slingshot Memphis. So what brings you to Memphis, and then how do you end up CEO Slingshot Memphis?
I have to just, in my mind, divine intervention is probably a big part of what happened here. So I had no desire in my career to work in the nonprofit space. I thought that I could use business to create good. You know, going to Africa was a way of kind of testing that out and saying, you know, I was always in a for-profit role in Africa, but I was trying to create social impact. And so that was always kind of where I thought I would be, is I would do something that's disruptive and would help people and benefit them through entrepreneurism and the for-profit sector. So when I decided it was time to leave my consulting career, I kind of, you know, did the traditional consultant, like, what am I looking for? Let's build this matrix of all the things that I want. And thought I found an organization here in Memphis that checked all those boxes. And so moved my family out here. We, you know, got set up in our house. We moved very quickly because the opportunity came very fast and said, all right, here we are. And within a few months, very clear that it wasn't the right place for me. You know, I've gotten more comfortable that I have different values than just kind of a lot of traditional for-profit approaches. And it wasn't the right fit. And so I find myself, you know, 6 months after I got here to Memphis, I'd resigned. Was looking for and trying to figure out what do I want to do next. And I'm here in Memphis with all my, at this point, we have 5 kids now. And he's like, what am I going to do? And so I actually said, I'm going to take some time and really kind of process this and figure it out. We didn't want to move our kids during the school year. My wife's a registered nurse. She'd always wanted to go back to you know, practicing being a nurse, but had taken time off in my consulting career because it's not very conducive for having a parent at home when you're traveling 4 days a week. And so she went back to be a nurse. I was a stay-at-home dad for several months. And it kind of said, what do I want to do with my life? What will I find fulfilling? And I opened the aperture from what I had always thought to kind of let new things in. And during that exploration, I came across Slingshot, quite honestly, through some connections I had with McKinsey, because we have several colleagues here that are from McKinsey. And one of our board members is a senior partner at McKinsey. And started talking to Justin Miller, the founding CEO, and it took several months before I kind of said, hey, maybe we should think about doing something. At that point, I was doing some independent consulting just to kind of keep myself busy. And so I said, well, hey, I'll do some consulting for Slingshot and we'll kind of, you know, do something in a part-time capacity. Did that at the end of 2019, connected with the team, connected further with the mission, this, you know, this idea of bringing a analytical, data-driven approach to philanthropy and fighting poverty while still keeping the heart and the compassion that is needed to do that. And so, you know, joined full-time beginning of 2020 as the managing director of measurement, where kind of my job was to kind of say, hey, like Slingshot spent several years figuring out this methodology, this framework. How do we kind of institutionalize this so we can replicate this now and work with more organizations? So that was kind of my focus in 2020. And then Justin decided that, you know, it was time for him to transition to a board role. I asked, you know, for the opportunity to be considered for that. And it all came together and it's been amazing. You know, it's the first position in my career that I've been in where I don't have a next step. I'm not saying I'll be here forever, but I love what I'm doing. I'm fulfilled by it, both kind of from a personal level and a professional level. And so I'm here until divine intervention tells me I'm not supposed to be here anymore. And it feels great because I've always been kind of, you know, looking for the next thing and trying to get there. And I'm not anymore. My next thing is, what's the next thing with Slingshot Memphis? What do we do next to kind of create greater change and help empower others? And so it's a very refreshing perspective to have relative to how I've kind of focused my career previously.
Well, and you have a chance to combine your passion and purpose, obviously, with your career, to take the skill sets and even the lens and the mindset shifts and the empathy, all of those experiences, to me, translate over perfectly into Slingshot Memphis in terms of the poverty fighting ecosystem, the analytics, the strategy, the innovation, everything that's going on. So for those who aren't familiar with Slingshot Memphis, how do you describe Slingshot Memphis?
Yeah, so the simplest way to describe Slingshot Memphis is we're a poverty fighting center of influence. To me, what that means is that we look at poverty from different angles. We uncover insights that haven't existed. We've developed a methodology to measure in an objective way what's effective and what's not, so that we can share that information with nonprofits, poverty fighting organizations, individual philanthropists, foundations, corporations, faith-based communities, to help them be more effective at achieving their aspirations when it comes to alleviating poverty. And so we don't believe there's a silver bullet that, you know, fixes poverty. We believe that there's an ecosystem of factors that contribute to poverty. And in order for an individual or a family to escape the challenges of poverty, that ecosystem needs to be addressed in a way that allows them to have opportunities and access to opportunities they didn't have before. And so our goal is to empower others in this ecosystem to be as effective as possible at what they're passionate about, so that we don't say, hey, you shouldn't do that or should do this, but saying, if you're going to do this, here's the need in the city, right? Here's how you can be most effective based on what research suggests is valid versus research suggests is less effective. Here's how you might think about allocating your resources. Here's how you can think about, for this organization, ways that it can have greater impact. And our goal is to really create this. The best way I put it is kind of becoming like the Amazon of poverty fighting information in Memphis, so that when you want to figure out, hey, I'm interested in after school programs, I'm interested in prenatal care, I'm interested in workforce development, we want to be able to provide insights that help you do that most effectively, so that we can have a dramatic change in poverty here in the city, and not just kind of keep doing what we've been doing, or not trying to do it with the heart that the city shows and everything that I get to experience. But combining that heart that we've had as a city with the resources to achieve the outcomes that we all want, which is people having access to opportunities to be personally and professionally successful and no longer have to face the challenges that you deal with when you're experiencing poverty.
I mentioned at the onset, to me, this is where philanthropy is headed. This is the next chapter in philanthropy. This is the disruption in the philanthropic community. In the sense that you are looking at proprietary algorithms and data to be able to look at, okay, what's working and what's creating impact. Because all of us as philanthropists, as investors in the community, when we're putting the dollars in philanthropically, we want to know that it's making a difference. We want to know that those dollars are being translated into real positive change for our community. And so when you look at the ability to look at impact, and great impact, and to help nonprofits understand, hey, look, while everything you're doing is great, these are the things that are creating the most impact. Let's really put more fuel to that fire. Let's add more resources. Let's be able to expand and scale these efforts because they're working. That information to me is invaluable. And so I think that's where, when you look at the game change in philanthropy, the ability to really look at the numbers and to not just the numbers per se, but the storylines, all the, you know, the subtext in there, but to see what's really working, that to me is the power behind Slingshot Memphis, is the partnerships you're creating, the relationships, but ultimately the ability to see and kind of understand impact is the game changer. What would you add from that context for you personally in terms of the game-changing element that Slingshot Memphis is really bringing as a disruptor, a positive disruptor within the philanthropic community?
Yeah. So, I mean, a way I think about it is it's a natural evolution of what's happened in other industries, right? So if you look at medicine, right, we were in a time in medicine where you would cut people and let them bleed and that would cure them, right? Or that was the hope, right? And or you would try all sorts of remedies hoping they would work. But we've progressed so far in medicine to we have all sorts of things we measure now, right? We know what a healthy blood pressure and unhealthy blood pressure is, right? We know how that interacts with other types of, you know, physiological challenges that people might experience. And we have the resources now for our doctors and our medical providers to provide infinitely better healthcare than, you know, 100, 200, 300 years ago. And therefore, the outcomes that we experience as patients are dramatically better, right? We live longer, we live healthier. We understand what's ailing us. We don't have to live with pain the way that we may have had to in the past, right? You look at that in other industries, businesses come along that way too, right? We have financial statements. Could you imagine making investments in organizations without understanding financially if they're successful or not, right? Like it seems crazy now, but you know, at some point in time, that was what happened. And people have created these tools and resources so that you can make informed investment decisions and know what companies are being successful or not. I'm a big sports guy, like I mentioned earlier. So, you know, sabermetrics and all sorts of analytics now involve sports, right? And you know more metrics than you care about to understand a player's performance and what, you know, what contributes to that performance and how do you, you know, try and replicate that. And so we're trying to do that now and bring that to philanthropy and poverty fighting, right? And so it's not like it's this weird, hairy brain thing that's never been done. It just hasn't been done in this space. And so we're bringing this methodology, we're bringing this ability that's helped other industries, and we're bringing it to a space that desperately needs it. Because unlike business where, you know, I'm making more money or less money, depending on the success of a business, here it's the quality of life for people, right? And it's affecting people, individuals, families, right? In a way that if we can get this to work here in philanthropy and in poverty fighting, that the impact is dramatic because it changes people's lives. And so that's what has me really excited about this, is that it's leveraging proven approaches in other spaces. We absolutely believe that you can't just do it without the heart. Like when you're helping people, you have to be thoughtful that these are people. They're not widgets, right? It's not like I can just say, well, hey, I do the same thing for every single person. I have similar principles that we approach with the organizations we work with and how we think about poverty alleviation. But at the end of the day, you have to customize it for the individual needs, personality, challenges of the families and individuals who are experiencing poverty. And so that's what has me excited, is that we're working towards doing this. And our goal is to create a movement, right? We can't do it by ourselves. We don't pretend to do it by ourselves. And at the end of the day, we don't work directly with people experiencing poverty. It's the nonprofits and other organizations that do. And so for us, the way that we achieve our mission is by pulling in philanthropists, foundations, governments, helping empower nonprofits and those that are dealing directly with those experiencing poverty to do what they do more effectively, to do what they do with the right tools, insights, data, and information. And to us, it's more than just, you know, you were saying more than just data, more than just numbers, contextualizing that, right? The influence piece in our mind of being a poverty fighting a center of influence is not that we just put a report out there and hope that people know what to do with it. It's to come up with these insights and help people understand what to do with it. We're very proactive on helping people understand what does that mean, whether it's a nonprofit that we get the opportunity to work with and conduct an impact study with to measure their effectiveness and help them understand what can they do with that information, to, you know, faith-based communities or foundations or individual philanthropists around helping them achieve their philanthropic aspirations and their poverty fighting aspirations. And how can they do that most effectively so that, again, as each part of this ecosystem starts to work more effectively, we produce that measurable change at scale for people here in the city that fundamentally will change, the poverty rates and the challenges that we've experienced for decades in the city, even though we've had the best intentions.
This is Jeremy Park, CEO of CityCurrent, personally inviting you to Growth Current. Growth Current is our e-learning and online personal development platform with CityCurrent. It's an opportunity to attend virtual events with global thought leaders, national guest speakers, and experts who can help you grow personally and professionally. It gives you access to success secrets, lessons learned, learning modules, and so much more. Subscriptions are only $8 a month, and you can do bulk subscriptions for your team. Check out growthcurrent.co to learn more. You have an amazingly brilliant team. You've had a chance even to present at the Paris Peace Forum. So you've already really had a nice bright spotlight shown on your efforts. Give us an illustration, though, when you talk about working with a nonprofit, and you don't necessarily have to name the nonprofit, but give us an illustration of how the process plays out, how your team really dives in and starts to be that resource and work together with a nonprofit to be more impactful with their efforts. So give us an illustration.
Yeah. So the first thing we do is we conduct, we call an impact study. And the first year we work with an organization, we do what we call a baseline impact study. And so for us, that starts by investing time to understand what they do. We don't want to presume we know what they do, and we try and avoid assumptions at all costs. And so we invest meaningful time through various meetings, through the information they share with us, to understand about their organization, to understand their aspirations, to understand what they feel makes them unique, what they are, you know, feel that they're trying to address, the social challenges they're trying to address. And then we really dig into the programs and services they offer so we can understand, you know, what are they providing? Why are they doing it? Why did they make those decisions? And that gives us the foundation then for us to work with. At that point, we then go through our framework of assessment, which is four dimensions. So the first is benefit cost ratio. Second is systems level change. Third is measurement infrastructure. And fourth is use of best practices. And so the benefit cost ratio is a quantitative evaluation. So we actually will produce a poverty fighting return on investment in a quantitative way. We're able to use research and those organizations' data to monetize the benefits they provide for the people they get to work with and compare that to the cost that it requires them to provide those benefits. Then we provide a qualitative perspective, although it's very rigorous still, around the impact they're having in the broader community, which is systems level change, the use of data and decision-making. So how effective are they at using their own data, their own information to improve their decision-making so that they're making decisions that are based on evidence, which is what we call our measurement infrastructure. And then we look at their approach to delivering their programming and compare that to the research verified best practices for trying to achieve those same outcomes to help them understand how does their approach compare to the approaches that are proven to be effective. And that's our use of best practices dimension. And so we go through a very methodical process. We bring these organizations along with us. We're very dialogue heavy because we feel like understanding requires discussion. And then we supplement that with external literature reviews and research to try and understand what's been proven to be effective, not just in Memphis, but in general. And then at the end of that, we review all that evidence with the organization. So we gather the evidence, we have them validate that with us. And then we conclude with our impact results. So we have a rubric we've developed for each of those four dimensions. We compare the evidence to that rubric to reach the results of the impact study with that organization. And then we also share with them opportunities for greater impact to help them think about, okay, now that we know this information, what are the things that they could do that enhance what they're doing? Whether they're already very effective or whether they're not yet very effective, there's always opportunities to improve is our mindset. And so we share those with them. And so that's year one. Then we offer thought partnership along the journey with them. So if they say, hey, you shared this opportunity with us, we think that's really interesting, or we thought of this opportunity on our own and want to get your input on this, we'll work with them and help them think through how they could approach that. And then each year we update their impact study to provide kind of an annual update. And so you can kind of see, have they improved in their effectiveness or regressed? And how have they done that? Where have they seen improvements? Where have they seen regression? And it's a way to annually understand where that change has happened so that we can help that organization understand it and that investors in those organizations also understand, has their dollars contributed towards, you know, having an impact in the people's lives that they're working with? And has it been progressing and improving or regressing? And if it's regressing, there's a fact base now to say why. And rather than just having to rely on anecdotes or, you know, perceptions, which unfortunately as humans, we're biased, we're made that way. And so our work then allows us to kind of set aside a lot of those biases and focus on evidence and a consistent framework to have those discussions around, you know, why have we seen improvement? How do we do more of that? Where has regression come in? How can we reverse that? And really create that set of tools to help organizations understand where they are and help investors understand where those organizations are and how they can best help those organizations.
What's been an aha moment for you when you look at going through the process and sitting down and working through all these different variables with the nonprofits and looking at these elements? What's been an aha moment for you navigating this?
Yeah. So one of the biggest aha moments for me actually came from some of the research that we've done across programs. And so one of the things you often hear about is, well, how many people are you working with? Right. And so the organizations are very quick to tell us that. I think, you know, in the philanthropic community, that's become a metric that people can measure that they have, you know, associated with. And oftentimes we use that as a proxy for how good a nonprofit might be. One of the big ahas for me is that when it comes to working with people, and I guess let me rephrase this here. In my for-profit experience, that also is a very common thing, right? So how many widgets are you making, right? How much production are you getting out of your, you know, your production line? That's a very common thing to look at. And you always want more, right? That was always the goal. How do we make more? How do we produce more? When it comes to dealing with people, the research shows that more is not always better. And the issue is much more about how do you create transformative change for a person if you want to help them have access out of poverty versus necessarily are you working with a lot more people? And that was a game changer because it was just a different paradigm for me of how I considered things. And so one of our beliefs is that it's not so much, and this is based on the research, is that we don't ask how many people you're working with other than allowing us to monetize the benefits. What we care about is how effective are your services? How effective are your is your programming? Because at the end of the day, if you work with 1,000 people, but it's not changing their lives, that doesn't help alleviate poverty. And if you're only working with 10 people, but all 10 of those people have pathways out of poverty and are now living much more fulfilling lives without the challenges that come with experiencing poverty, that's what we want. That's what we care about. And so it's been a game changer and an aha moment for me that the key is less around how many people are being worked with, but how effectively are they being worked with and how is it transforming their life? And so it's been a big kind of shift as we go. Our former CEO, Justin Miller, founding CEO, would often say, you know, ask the right questions. And so this is one of those that's become in my mind is that question is how effective are your services at changing the lives of the people that you're working with in a way that helps alleviate poverty versus many other questions that I think are often asked because we've had the ability, that's how it's always been done, or we've had an ability to measure something, even if it doesn't answer that question of, is it effective?
I think this is one we could almost do a whole nother podcast on, but I think that's a perfect example of how in the philanthropic community, we're focused on some of the wrong things. We're asking the wrong questions. And so give me another example of how philanthropy needs to change. What are some of the things that we need to, you know, the questions that need to be shifted, the mindsets that need to be shifted? What are some of those things that really do need to be shifted? And I'm even thinking around looking at board diversity and, you know, do you have those you serve on your board? You know, so you have a voice from the people that you're serving. Like there's a lot of things I think that the shifts that need to happen in philanthropy, but from your vantage point, what do some of those look like?
Yeah. So I'll share a couple here that are just kind of top of mind. So one, in the for-profit space, you would never develop a product without doing consumer research, right? You'd want to understand what is your consumer need? What are their pain points? What are their challenges? That doesn't always happen when it comes to fighting poverty, right? A very powerful data point in understanding what's working and what's not working is the people who are experiencing it, right? And so, you know, taking a similar approach of our for-profit, you know, kind of mindset of understanding what the consumer's challenges are and doing that in the poverty fighting and nonprofit space is a powerful way of doing something different and understanding, you know, the voice of the consumer or the voice of those who know it better than anyone else because they're living it, right? So that's one thing that is important for us. It's something that we're actively trying to incorporate more of in our work as we've realized how valuable that perspective is and how, again, parallel it is to other industries where you do that research first. Another piece around this is the, you know, one of our core values is urgency, right? And so if I'm an investor and I'm a prudent investor, I don't sit on a bank account with my investment and every now and then, you know, put a little bit in the stock market or invest in a company, right? I want to deploy those resources because I know the sooner I deploy it, the greater return I'm going to get. And there's that compounding effect on that investment. That doesn't always happen in philanthropy. We often have a lot of resources that are sitting, you know, in donor advised funds or in foundations or in other places that aren't always being deployed in a way that I would do them if I was doing that in my for-profit space. And so, you know, the issue is, imagine if you were deploying instead of hundreds of thousands of dollars, or, you know, ones and tens of millions of dollars, but I'm doing that at hundreds of millions of dollars. The impact you can have with a $100 million investment is so much more transformative than the impact I could have with a $100,000 investment over 100 years. And so it's bringing in some of these successful tools and approaches that we've seen in other places, and finding a very thoughtful and mindful way of how that works when it comes to philanthropy and how that works in fighting poverty. And again, I don't think we can do that without heart. Like, that's what's different. Sometimes in business, you know, I've seen the whole spectrum of how people approach making money. Some of those are inspiring, a lot of those are not. But even the ones that aren't still make money, unfortunately, sometimes. When it comes to philanthropy and it comes to fighting poverty, I don't think we can effectively alleviate poverty without a values-based approach and using our heart and the human-to-human aspect of that, right? And, you know, I think part of that, too, is also being able to empathize and understand those challenges, even though we don't experience them ourselves always, right? I've had experiences in my childhood where my dad was unemployed, where I had a paper route to pay for my sports that I wanted to play, because without that, I couldn't do it. But that's very different than what a lot of people might experience in South Memphis or in Fraser. Very different than what people experienced that I saw in Ghana or in, you know, the slums of Nairobi. You know, and so it's different in each place. There's some commonalities and some similar principles, but I think we have to be able to take ourselves in a way where we can develop a level of empathy and understanding through the various tools that are available to us to really make that change. And so the goal is, how do we take all of that heart, right? And then bringing in all these other opportunities that we found successful in other places and really merge those together in a powerful way so that we get the best of both, right? We get all of that heart, all of that desire, and then all of the tools and resources that we know exist to achieve what we want here. And so this gets a little bit around my view of my faith, is it's, you know, I'm going to do everything I can and then trust God to help fill the gap. Now, what I do and what God does is very different. But I think when it comes to philanthropy and fighting poverty, it's the same, where we're going to, you know, do everything we can. Let's use all the things we know work in various industries and find a way to get them to work here. And then hope that through the heart, the connection, the empathy, that we can help make sure that we apply those in the right way, and that we can fill the voids that, you know, I can't take something off and perfectly from, you know, a chemical manufacturing approach and apply that to a workforce development, you know, program, but I can take those principles and trust that if I work with those people, I can find a way to apply those successful principles to, you know, an analogous program when it comes to poverty alleviation.
Two more questions, and then we'll switch over to a lightning round. One is on the investment side and the urgency side. You are structured very uniquely in the sense that you have a set of donors that really covers your personnel costs, your operations costs, so that the dollars you raise from the community are 100% invested back in. And so it's a unique model on your end in terms of how you're structured. And I think that you mentioned the dollar sitting on the sidelines. People love a winner. When they know that the dollars are working and they're creating impact, I think that opens up a lot more eyes and ears, and it gets people to get off the sidelines and say, wait, that's working. I want to invest in because I'm seeing that ROI. I'm seeing that return on investment with the community in a good way. And so I think all of those kind of play together in a really unique way to be able to create urgency to add that fuel to the fire. So share a little bit about just kind of how you're structured and the fact that the community dollars flow through to these nonprofits at a very high level.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, we have a very generous set of investors that fund all of our operations because we're a nonprofit ourselves. Slingshot Memphis is a 501c3 nonprofit. And so we have people who fund our operations. Jeremy, you alluded to our team, which, you know, I couldn't be more happy to work with. They're great people first, but they're also extremely talented. That, you know, they're educated. They have experience working with poverty fighting organizations like on the front lines. We have this just really neat mix. And so we cover all of that separately. We also invite others to participate in our movement and our effort by saying, hey, I want to invest based on impact. maybe I don't have the time to go figure out which organizations are most effective. I don't have the tools because they don't exist, right? That's why we exist, is we were creating those tools and providing them. And so we provide an avenue through what we call our Impact Accelerator Fund for people to contribute their funds to that. And 100% of those funds are invested directly in the organizations we work with. We don't have to charge a management fee or any kind of overhead. We're able to direct that directly into these organizations we work with. And what's great is we do that in an extremely transparent way. So the criteria we use is how much impact are they creating today? And that's based on our impact studies that we conduct. And what's been their trajectory? Have they been creating greater impact over time or less impact over time? And those are the two criteria we use to invest those resources. And so we disproportionately invest in the organizations we work with that are effective and that are showing a positive trajectory in their poverty fighting effectiveness. And we invest less in those that don't. And then we encourage those that don't and help provide resources and tools for them to be able to be more effective. And so it's a really simple and transparent approach that we think drives impact because we're supporting what's working and trying to empower and enhance those things that could be more effective. And so that's kind of our approach. And it's all anchoring off this concept of not knowing what's worked in the past and now having a way through our impact studies and our methodology to understand that.
And then the last one before we switch over to the lightning round is offer some words of encouragement. When you look at the disruption, the innovation, the changing guard of philanthropy and everything that you're a part of with Slingshot Memphis, what are your words of encouragement for others, especially who are outside of the Memphis area, to be more intentional, to look at impact, to ask better questions? What would your words of encouragement be?
Yeah, my words of encouragement are that it works. And so, you know, we've worked with several organizations for multiple years now, and we looked at the organizations we looked at worked with in 2019 and also conducted impact studies with them in 2020. And 90% of those organizations showed measurable improvement. We can point to exactly how they improved in a material way with this information. And so it was really inspiring to see that when provided with this information, you know, the leadership teams of these poverty fighting organizations were able to go and do things that made them more effective. We've also seen funds funnel to these organizations based on, you know, the impact that they're having. And so, you know, we've seen them change some of their programming to things that, you know, they're uniquely positioned to deliver and do it in an effective way and funnel away from things that they might be less effective relative to other poverty fighting organizations in the city. And so that's been really inspiring for me, is that we're seeing it work as people get this information and seeing, and we're able to measure those changes. And so for me, you know, again, ask the questions, right? Like, I wouldn't go to a doctor and say, how many patients have you provided surgery for, right? I'd go to a doctor and say, what's been the outcome of those surgeries, right? How many people have been, you know, cured by that? Like, do that same thing when it comes to poverty alleviation, right? And how many people are better off now? How has their health improved? How has their income improved because of your programming and services, right? We have tools available for the first time on our website right now that we call them an impact profile summary. It's a short 2-page summary of an organization's poverty fighting effectiveness. And we have that up for about half the organizations that we work with right now. And so the opportunities, you can come and see, what are we measuring, right? What are we using to identify how effective these organizations are? And take that same methodology and use it on your own, right? You know, you don't have to invest through our impact fund, Impact Accelerator Fund, to have, you know, an impact in the organization you work with, but you can use the approaches we're using, where you can use the information that we've gathered for similar organizations and use that to inform how you think about running your nonprofit, how you think about investing as an individual philanthropist to be more effective. And so for me, it's exciting because it's working, right? You know, I came in with all sorts of doubts into the nonprofit space around creating impact and how effective it might be. And as I mentioned, I have no desire, you know, no plans of leaving now, because I'm convinced that what we're doing can work and can help others. And so I'm excited to do that. And so, you know, my hope is that others will kind of join us in this movement, right? You know, ask the right questions, use these resources that we've provided, and we're planning on providing many, many more. As I said, we want to become this hub of poverty fighting insights and resources. So just like, you know, you go on to buy something, you go to Amazon, you want to learn about poverty and how to be more effective, you can come to our website over time as we continue to redevelop and build that out. and encourage others to do that as well, right? So rather than saying, oh, great, that you're working with 300 people, awesome, ask those next set of questions. It really helps that organization think about the impact they're having. It helps you understand the impact that they're having.
Yeah, great, great stuff. Let's switch over. Lightning round, short questions, short answers. What do you like to do to relax?
I love camping and hiking. Getting in the outdoors, especially in places where my phone doesn't work, is my jam. I love being out there, the serenity, the peace. It's where I refresh and recharge.
So where's a go-to spot outside of the Mid-South? Where do you like to go to vacation?
So I love national parks. I've been to over half of them. My goal in my lifetime is to hike all of them. But Southern Utah is probably my soft spot for outdoors. The diversity between the rock formations and the scenery, and it's just a wonderland for me to kind of be there and just, you know, there's five national parks all within a couple hours of each other, and you just get to explore all sorts of different things there.
So what does your wife like to do to relax?
So my wife also likes to go to the outdoors. Camping has kind of become our family thing. You know, recently I took my older two kids to the Sipsey Wilderness in Northern Alabama, and we did some backcountry camping, a little colder than we thought. And you're walking through some rivers there, so it was a little colder, but it was great. But my wife's idea of relaxing is going to the beach. She's the kind of person that, you know, her vacation is spending days and days and days just sitting on the beach and doing things. I get antsy after about an hour and want to go do the next thing and explore. And so we've learned over our 16 years of marriage now how to kind of balance the exploring with the relaxing at the beach.
Yeah, we can relate to that. So where do you like to take people who come from out of town, come visit Memphis? Where do you like to take them?
Great question. So I am a sucker for the jerk wings at Central Barbecue. And so when I bring people, that, you know, when friends come to town, that's usually my go-to is Central Barbecue on Central whenever possible. That was the first, you know, Central Barbecue I went to when I visited Memphis. And so that's one place that I like to take people. Another place I like is actually Shelby Farms, because it's fun to get, you know, it's a taste of the outdoors. I think it's one of the unique things about Memphis that we preserve this awesome land. I'm an outdoor nerd. I like agriculture. I'm kind of, you know, that's, and so it's just a neat place to kind of take people and go see the buffalo or just go for a walk out there and enjoy, you know, my outdoors, you know, within a few minutes of my house.
What's something that you've learned from your kids?
A lot. So I grew up very competitive. I was the kind of person where if I lost a football game on a Friday night, you probably shouldn't talk to me till Sunday. you know, I just, that was kind of how I was wired. My kids are so much more mature than I am at their age, where, you know, I have a 13-year-old, an 11-year-old, an 8-year-old, and twin 5-year-olds. And we have number 6 coming here in December. So a full house. But my older two kids just are grounded. They're very thoughtful about, you know, winning and losing a game, right, is not the end of the world for them. You know, and they're very creative and have learned how to express themselves through various forms. And they're kind to other people, right? Like that's something that I really admire about my kids is that they're thoughtful about others. They have friends in the little cove we live in. They have friends at school that they just, you know, that time together and that connection with their friends is really valuable to them. And, you know, I think I went through a period of life where I substituted that for achievement, for prestige, for, you know, career progression, at the sacrifice of my own health, both mentally and physically. And so I've definitely learned that a lot from them around how valuable it is to just express who you are and be comfortable with that and to have the connection with friends and others that you care about.
This kind of ties into that, but, and you don't have to get it exactly right, but what's a quote that inspires or moves you?
I've got two that come to mind in different contexts. So kind of in my work life, one thing that I've really enjoyed is I had someone share with me outside of a work environment that never tear down a fence until you understand why it was built. And for me, that's always stuck with me. And it really what it gets at is empathy, because it helps me understand, okay, it's easy to come in, especially as a former consultant, to kind of come in and find something that's not working perfectly. I mean, I'm trained with that. That was part of my job, was to find opportunities. And part of what we do at Slingshot as well a bit. But understanding the why is really valuable. And so that's been helpful for me, not just in a professional sense, but also in a personal sense. The other one that's been really powerful for me, and this actually came when I was in South Africa from a colleague of mine there, was that people don't remember how awesome your PowerPoint presentation was, how cool the analysis is that you did. You know, they don't remember that stuff. What people remember is how you made them feel. And so since then, that's always been a goal of mine. And I wish I was better at it and continue to strive to be, but people care about how you make them feel, because in life, it's the relationships that I've found are the most valuable thing you can have. And so that's become, you know, a lifelong kind of goal for me, is to seek ways to make others feel inspired when they're around me because of what I do and how I respect them, but also just how I try and live. And so those are two quotes that I think I've found really inspiring and am trying to embrace in all that I do.
That carries us forward to the last question before we wrap up with contact information, is the legacy question. Obviously, you know, you're young, you're creating your legacy every single day. It ties back to exactly what you said in terms of how you make others feel. But what do you hope many years from now your legacy is, not just with Slingshot Memphis, but obviously with you and your family and the impact you're able to make in a larger scheme?
Yeah, this has changed a lot. I used to think, like, you know, I wanted to be the person that, you know, created penicillin, or, you know, did something that was just this huge thing. But I don't actually know who created penicillin. I don't know anything about that person. I'm grateful for them, but I just don't know. And so for me, it's changed from this like macro view of things that's impersonal to very much a much more micro view of things, where my hope is that my legacy is that people felt inspired and were able to gain something from our relationship, our interaction, in a way that helped benefit their life. And so obviously directly, that's my children and my wife, where, you know, my hope is that I'm helping empower my kids pursue what they're interested in, where their strengths and talents are, whether that's my colleagues who I'm lucky enough to get to work with here at Slingshot, whether that's, you know, peers in grad school together, or whatever, you know, or the people we get to work with in the poverty fighting organizations. My hope is that in some way I'm doing something that helps them and leaves them better off for our interaction. And I don't care if anybody remembers me anymore. You know, what I care about is that those people that I interacted with found something of value in our relationship. And if, you know, if nobody knows that, if it never ends up, you know, in a news article, great, I don't care. What I care about is that legacy, is knowing that those people that I worked with touched my life and that I had a chance to help and do something in some way to help their life.
We'll wrap up with contact information on where we can follow and learn more about Slingshot Memphis. As you mentioned, you're putting out a lot of helpful resources. So where does everyone go to learn about Slingshot Memphis, to access those resources, and then also to follow you and your efforts personally as well?
Yeah. So our website is slingshotmemphis.org, and that's where you can come. We're in the, you know, we have a new website we've refreshed and are in the process of again, building out this hub of information there. And so that's the best place to kind of go and learn what we do, learn the things that you can do to try and be more effective at what you want to achieve when it comes to poverty alleviation. And then you can also follow us via social media. So we have a LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram are our primary social media platforms. We try and stay active on that and want to, you know, communicate with those who are interested in this movement. You know, you can also, you know, invest and join invest in our Impact Accelerator Fund and join our email list. That will give you access to things earlier and things that we kind of share just with our supporters and our stakeholders. And so all of those things are ways that you can interact with us and engage with us as we go forward and as we continue to kind of build this movement, again, that we believe will transform how we fight poverty and transform the outcomes that people therefore get to experience.
Yep. And for you personally, you're on LinkedIn, I know, and some of the social media. So that's an easy way to follow you, especially on LinkedIn. So, yep, Jared,
that's my primary social media for sure.
Yeah, I was about to say that makes it easy. So, Jared, you are a change maker. You and Slingshot Memphis are doing amazing things. Greatly appreciate you sharing your time and your expertise and coming on the Change Makers podcast.
Thanks so much, Jeremy. Excited about you. Appreciate the opportunity here. And I want to put my plug out for City Current as well. And, you know, we've been to several of the events that you have done and the City Current has done, and have found that really informative as well and how we think about things and again, get different perspectives around our work. So thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Changemakers Podcast, produced by City Current and brought to you by Lipscomb and Pitts Insurance. To learn more about our guests and share your stories of others leading by example, visit us online at citycurrent.com or follow us on social media using @citycurrent. Please make sure to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast wherever you listen. Now, think big, start small, and act now. Be a changemaker.